This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. Forecasters predict one of the worst droughts in Massachusetts history is only going to get worse. The panel of experts monitoring the situation in Massachusetts says the lack of rain coupled with low groundwater tables will remain a threat to farmers in the state and create elevated fire risks. Just the same, some drinking water reservoirs are doing fine, such as the Quabbin and the Wachusett, which supply Greater Boston. But it's a different story in other communities, and in over 140, water use restrictions have been imposed. That's the case in Scituate, where the Public Works Director, Kevin Cafferty, tells us the town's primary water source, the Scituate Reservoir, is precariously low.
A good term that people have used is it looks like a moonscape. We're down about 5.5 feet from where we usually are, but it's a very large area. Typically, the reservoir holds 155 million gallons. The reservoir is down about 25% of that 155 million gallons now. We're losing, say, maybe a percent every 2 days.
Every 2 days. So that's a pretty steep decline.
It's significant, yes.
I've seen estimates that there's only a 30 to 40 day water supply left in the reservoir. Do you think that's pretty accurate?
We hope a little more, but that's in the ballpark.
So when you look at the reservoir and you see the data, Kevin, how worried are you?
Well, of course we're worried. We're taking everything into consideration of what we can do to keep it up. This area here probably hasn't seen a drought like this in 40 to 60 years.
Any idea why the Scituate Reservoir is as low as it is, and yet the Quabbin and Wachusett Reservoirs are still up at 80 or more percent capacity?
Talking to the meteorologists, we've been on the edge of the rain for a lot of the rain areas and the drought areas. This week, there was heavy rain in Baltimore. There was also some heavy rain in Long Island, I believe, where they got 6 inches plus. It's not reaching this area. And usually our reservoir does decline. That's how it's designed, that we build up a capacity in the winter and we use it up in the summer. The problem that's concerning us most is it's down a lot lower than it should be. Typically, in a typical year, this level we would see maybe near the end of the season before the rain starts. We're still earlier in the summer, and it's down this low.
Okay, tell us about the restrictions right now. What can town residents do and not do in terms of water use?
The biggest issue is there's no irrigation. There's no hoses outside. There's not washing cars. You could water if you had a vegetable garden, but you would have to use a watering can. If people are caught irrigating, they do get fined. It starts off at $50, and then if it's a second offense, it goes up to $100.
Could those restrictions become even more severe?
You know, everything's possible. We'll continue to watch how bad the drought is and see where we get to at that time.
Let me ask you one more question. As you go around town and you speak to residents, do they seem to be understanding about the restrictions at this point, knowing that they haven't seen any rain?
The residents have been very understanding, and they've been working a lot with us. Since we've introduced these mandatory restrictions, our water usage has dropped probably 300,000 gallons per day, which is significant, and that's been a big help. Going around talking to different residents, if we see somebody out with a hose, obviously we speak to them, and they are very understanding. For the majority of the people we've talked to are very, very supportive.
Kevin, thank you very much, and good luck.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Kevin Cafferty is the Director of Public Works for the town of Scituate. It's standard medical care. Newborn babies are routinely given a shot of vitamin K to help clot their blood. But some new parents are declining the shots in a move that some doctors disagree with, as WBUR's Kerry Goldberg reports.
The baby was born full term and healthy, but now, just a few weeks later, lay limp and unresponsive, barely breathing.
This baby was diagnosed with bleeding in the brain, and babies that suffer intracranial bleeding or bleeding in the brain unfortunately suffer damage that can be lifelong.
Dr. Ivana Kulik is a neonatologist, a specialist in newborns, at Boston Children's Hospital and medical director of the special care nursery at Beverly Hospital.
Personally, it is actually really hard to take care of any infant that is sick, but when you realize a severe illness was completely preventable. That is something that is really hard for everyone to comprehend and deal with in our field.
The child survived, but medical privacy rules bar Kulik from revealing more details of this recent Boston area case she saw. She could say this: the parents of the baby had refused the standard shot of vitamin K that she says would almost certainly have prevented the brain bleed. There's no national tracking of vitamin K refusals, but in recent years, anecdotal reports from hospitals and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have described clusters of several babies who had brain bleeds and whose parents had declined the vitamin K shot. Dr. Robert Sidonio Jr. of Emory University documented one such cluster in Nashville in 2013. 5 babies with brain bleeds over 6 months. It turned out, he says, that over 3% of Nashville parents were declining vitamin K shots, and in nearby communities with birthing centers, nearly 30% were declining the vitamin K shot.
And this isn't a relatively, medium-sized city that tends to be relatively conservative, and so that was sort of shocking to us that there were that many parents declining it. It was quite shocking to the CDC as well.
So why would a parent decline a treatment that's been standard for more than 50 years and proven to prevent a serious risk? Dr. Ben Wheeler of the University of Otago in New Zealand has just published the first in-depth look at what motivates parents who decline the vitamin K shot for their newborns. Data from interviews with 15 families published in the Journal of Medical Ethics points to a range of factors, from religious beliefs to the conviction that natural is better.
We believe God created us and knew what he was doing.
Is one thing Wheeler heard from parents.
Other ones, such as if baby really needed more vitamin K, they'd get it from me.
Some of it is based on not wanting to have the baby have that pain.
Dr. Christy Waterberg chairs the Committee on Newborns of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She says some parents are just misinformed.
I think that people have to be more careful. There are so many things on the internet that are absolutely not true. They have no basis in fact.
Doctors need to be sure to provide better information in a personal way, says Dr. Ivana Kulik, the neonatologist from earlier.
We should always try to ask parents why are they trying to refuse it, try to alleviate the fears and explain where the misunderstanding is, and try our best not to let this happen.
The sort of bleed she saw is rare, Kulik says. But when it happens, when a baby goes from healthy at birth to severely ill, it's a nightmare. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
You might not know the art world name, Delarobia, but the vivid blue and white glazed sculptures made by members of the Delarobia family during the Italian Renaissance can seem familiar. The innovative family artists Luca, Andrea, and Giovanni created sculptures that decorate churches and important buildings all around Florence. Their signature style inspired reproductions that you can find in Boston and in other cities. And now, 46 sculptures from the family's workshop fill the first major Delarobia showing in this country. WBUR's Andrea Shea visited the Museum of Fine Arts as the exhibit was being installed.
MFA senior curator Marietta Cambereri has been dreaming about this exhibition for 6 years. She smiles with glee and a little trepidation now that the Delarobia sculptures borrowed from about 24 institutions around the U.S. and Italy are in Boston.
The largest piece in the gallery has arrived, and we are in the process of uncrating it, making sure that it traveled from Brooklyn to Boston safely, and we are going to lift it up onto a wall. It weighs, I think, 1,100 pounds, and so it's a very, very nerve-wracking and very exciting day.
Museum engineers designed a custom rigging system to lift and mount the nearly 12-foot-wide Resurrection of Christ onto the wall. It's the first piece visitors will encounter in the new show titled Della Robbia, Sculpting with Color in Renaissance Florence. And it's epic. Museum conservators hover around the work's dramatic biblical scene, gushing over its color and shine.
Just some random glaze glosses on some of these.
Brooklyn Museum Chief Conservator Lisa Bruno has been overseeing the sculpture's year-long restoration in New York. It came into the collection there in 1899, and she says it's never been conserved. Up close, it looks like a giant puzzle. 46 individual pieces are held together by a large wooden frame. Giovanni Della Robbia was commissioned to make it in the early 1500s. He and his relatives ran a bustling workshop in Florence during the Renaissance, when marble and bronze sculptures were everywhere. But Giovanni's great-uncle, Luca Della Robbia, broke away and invented a new glazed terracotta technique. Cambereri says the material gives the Resurrection of Christ shimmer and life.
The other beautiful thing about this material is that because it's a ceramic glaze, essentially the color has not changed since these left the Renaissance workshops. So it really is a picture of Renaissance color.
Conservator Lisa Bruno calls the Resurrection of Christ a tour de force of glazing.
I think initially you may look at this object and think, oh, it's sort of kitschy. But it's actually a really incredibly stunning piece of Italian Renaissance sculpture.
MFA Objects Conservator Abigail Hyken understands why the perception that Della Robbia's sculptures are kitschy persists. She believes some people feel like they know them because they may have grown up with religious figurines that riff on Della Robbia's many blue and white interpretations of, say, the Madonna.
I think people feel like they've seen them. My aunt said, oh, my grandmother had Della Robbia. There was a time when people had these in their homes. Even here in the U.S., just blue and white Madonna and child things. So I think people will see that it's a lot more.
Lisa Bruno sure hopes so. She calls the Della Robbia a family of innovators for forging new ways to make durable, eye-catching sculptures. The Resurrection of Christ shows Jesus bursting from the tomb as Roman soldiers freak out around him. Angels float over their heads. The scene is framed by colorful insects, animals, and fruit, not only blue and white, but yellow, brown, and varying flesh tones. For Bruno, this is the Della Robbia at the top of their game. She recalls using UV reflective imaging to learn more about the family's technique by focusing on a particular part of Jesus's anatomy, his abs.
He really has a six-pack, and it's but it showed that they were applying the glaze in a painterly manner. So they were using the glaze to articulate the musculature.
On Jesus's right, there's a blonde man praying. He represents the Italian family that commissioned this piece centuries ago. Descendants of the Antinori family are funding the conservation and installation of the hefty Resurrection of Christ. The Antinoris have been making wine in Tuscany for 26 generations. Alicia Antinori traveled to Boston just to see the newly restored Resurrection of Christ and the new exhibition. The Brooklyn Museum bought the piece from the Antinori family in 1899, and she says her family is eager to help pay for its care.
My dream would be once to have it also for a little period back home, because I think maybe in his life he should come back home too. But we are very related to the arts and to what we have done in our family, so it was the minimum that we could do.
Antinori hopes this first U.S. show dedicated to Della Robbia will expose their telltale glazing technique to a wider audience. The sculptures are part of her landscape back home in Tuscany.
They are in churches. They are in one church in close to our house, which has many pieces in it.
And the Della Robbia can be seen on buildings around Boston, too.
Once you start looking for them, you find them everywhere.
Curator Marietta Cambereri has lived in Brookline Village for 15 years, but she didn't notice a Della Robbia-inspired relief in her own neighborhood until about 5 years ago.
I was taking the bus down Harvard Ave on one of those very snowy days, and happened to be standing looking out the window, and I thought, I just saw a Dalarobia go by. And I came back, and there it was.
It's on the St. Mary of the Assumption Elementary School.
Above the door is a wonderful and unusual early 20th century reworking of a famous Luca Dalarobia that lives today in the Bargello Museum in Florence.
It's one example, Camberry says, of American interest in Dalarobia in the early 20th century. Her research intern found nearly two dozen Dalarobia-style pieces on other schools and churches around Boston. You can see little babies, also called the Innocente, on the exterior of Brigham and Women's Hospital. Camberry believes many of them were made by the Atlantic Terracotta Company for American architects who might have seen Dalarobia in Brooklyn or Florence. She hopes the new exhibition will reignite an interest in the Renaissance technique that only lasted for about a century.
And I hope people walk around Boston and notice more. Look up. You might see a Dalarobia.
There is even a duplicate of a Dalarobia original that Camberry says was reported to be part of a church sanctuary in Roxbury that she believes disappeared. For 90.9 WBUR and The Artery, I'm Andrea Shea.
Dalarobia, Sculpting with Color in Renaissance Florence, is on display at the MFA now through December 4th.